Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd. I'm here tonight with my co-host, Red Beckman. Red, would you like to say hello?
Yeah, hello.
Red, would you care to open us with a prayer tonight, please?
Well, I'll tell you, I don't have much voice. give me a break, will you?
I will. I'll be glad to. Well,
I don't have much voice.
You're a little bit froggy tonight, huh?
I'm really about out of voice. I'll do a lot of listening tonight.
That's okay. I'll open us up. Thanks. Almighty Father in heaven, we just thank you so much for this beautiful day. We're thankful for all the ways that you bless us, especially here at Walls in Our Minds. You bless us with a great guest tonight. You bless us with good friends and good listeners, and we just are very thankful, and we lift up your son, Yahushua, our HaMashiach, our Savior, our King, and to you, and just are so thankful for his sacrifice. And we pray that you really fill us this night with your spirit, the spirit that you send in your son's name. And we pray that you go before us in everything we do and say tonight. Please be with our guest, Ron McDonald, and open the hearts and the minds of our listeners tonight. It's in the name of your son we pray. Amen. Well, our guest is here with us, Red, already, and I think we just should just launch right in and introduce Ron McDonald, the author of They Own It All, Including You. And Ron, just welcome to Walls in Our Minds. I know you've done a lot of radio. And we're looking forward to hearing from you tonight. So would you like to just say hello, and I'll get us started by maybe telling our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Certainly. I do say hello to everyone. I've heard so much about Red Beckman over the years. It's a pleasure to be on the show with him. And a good evening to your audience. I imagine, what time is it there? Probably 8 o'clock?
Well, our audience really is from coast to coast.
So it's different time zones.
And actually, Red's on the Pacific time zone. He's up in Washington State, so he's in the same time zone as you, and I'm just an hour later than you here at in Parker, Colorado.
Okay. Gotcha. A little bit about myself. I got into law about 35 years ago, and it happened, it occurred basically when a young man came to me, and I was young then too, and said, "Don't you feel something's wrong, you know? Don't you get something's wrong?" And he was kind of hippie-ish, but he was a friend of mine. And I thought about that question, and I decided, well, I'm going to just try and concentrate on it. And I went through the day trying to recognize those things I couldn't do without permission. And I found out I couldn't get in my car without putting my seatbelt on. I couldn't drive without a license. I couldn't add to on my house without a permit. And it went on and on and on. I says, oh, my God, there's so much pressure out there. There is so much pressure out there. We just aren't aware of it. I said, we're restrained. We don't have freedoms. And that actually got me involved in law. And from that point on, I've done many cases, and I've won every one of them. And they're extraordinary cases, things that your average attorney, and I, by the way, I'm not a licensed attorney, but your average attorney could not win because he's not taught law specifically. The Did you want more or what?
Yeah. Tell us more, because I've heard you talk about you know, what you did with your dad's case, and
okay,
and I think people would really appreciate that, because it really shows the passion that you you came into this with, and the depth of research you were willing to go to be able to deal with that.
Okay. Yeah, in my dad's case, my dad was a truck driver. He's actually Sergeant of Arms of Local 85. He's a guy that beat up people, took the guns away. He was really kind of a violent man, but he was also an alcoholic, and he drove truck for a living, but never once got in an accident. Over the years, he had been transporting cargo or whatever you want to call it in the commerce jurisdiction. But he came up to see me. I'm up in the Guerneville area. I was hosting a PTA carnival, and he came up with my mom, and there was some altercation back at his home, so he was racing back, and he'd already had a couple of drinks. He was racing back to get to his home because someone was breaking into it, and he went up this hill and crossed a double line to pass a car in front of him as a highway patrolman was coming down the hill, and of course he pulled back into the lane in front of the car and then ran and hid on a dirt road. Well, the highway patrol just followed the dust trail and caught him, you know. So he was arrested, and he was given a citation. My mom paid his, whatever it was, $1,000 or something for bail. And then he was to appear in court. And when he got into court, they asked for me to defend them. He was issued a complaint. So I looked at the complaint, and I noticed there were things wrong with the complaint. And the things that I noticed that were wrong with the complaint is wrong in every complaint issued by a highway patrol across the country. First of all, the complaint was signed by a highway patrol officer, Jim England, here in Sonoma County. And what that meant is that he endorsed the complaint. He selected the counts against my father, which was three of them, evading an officer, under the influence, and reckless driving. He also moved in the name of the people of the state of California, and he also filed the complaint with the court clerk. So those are the things that he had done wrong. And basically what I did is I wrote an 18-page brief with, of course, case law. You need case law. You need the enforcement of the laws. You need the interpretation of the law. That's the case law. And everything that was required for a nice brief. And in it, it said that the highway patrolman had no authority to arrest my father and charge the complaint in that matter, because in so doing, he usurped power that was delegated specifically to the office of the district attorney. Well, I did a writ of prohibition on that, and I brought it in to serve the judge in the matter. And when I went into court, where my dad was supposed to go to the trial, the judge looked at the writ of prohibition and looked at my dad and says, "Did you write this?" He says, "You're going to trial right now," real sarcastically. He says, "That's what you get for writing your own paperwork." Well, I was in the back sitting with a group of people, you know, watching things, and I stood up and I says, "Your Honor." And he says, "Well, who are you?" And I says, "I'm Ron McDonald." And he says, "Oh, you're Ron McDonald." And I says, "You have been served. You're commanded to desist and refrain from any further action against the defendant. And you're further commanded to appear in the court of Chief Justice Lawrence Sawyer to answer why you have moved against the defendant." Well, the judge's face turned red. I mean, absolutely red. And then he turned to deputy district attorneys in the room prosecuting my dad. He turned to them and said, "Did you get one of these?" And they said, "Yes, Your Honor." He says, "Is your sign?" And they said, "Yes, turn to page 2. And he turned to page 2 and he saw the chief justice, the chief judge of the county signature on there. And I further told him, I says, "You're to appear 30 days from now in his court to answer and respond to this writ of prohibition." Well, he turned to me and he says, "I'll tell you what, you go there and you come back and let us know what's happening with the case." Well, I also served as a respondent, the district attorney, Gene L. Tunney, at the time. Neither one of them showed up in the chief judge's court, but I took standing in that courtroom. I walked up there as though I was an attorney, and I took standing, and I argued the brief But basically, when I got there, the chief judge turned to me and says, you know, you've won the merits of the case, which are the facts, because neither the judge, Frank Passalacqua, or the district attorney, Gene L. Tunney, had responded to the writ. However, I had to review the law of the case, and I read it and reread it, and he said this about 8 times. And he says, you know, I could find no fault with it. You're absolutely right. No one can sign a complaint in the name of the people or move in the name of the people unless it's that district attorney. Not even the assistant district attorneys can do that. I'm issuing a preemptory writ and dismissing this case in its entirety. And great job, counselor. And I left. So this happens in every county of every state. It's usually an officer and not the prosecuting officer of your county that developed these complaints. And there's an old book in the state of California that an old law in the state of California that's on the books, and I'm sure it's probably in every other state, is that the district attorney gets paid 10% of every complaint that goes into that courtroom. So it's advantageous for him to have, like, the sheriff department write a complaint or the medical board write a complaint, any agency write a complaint and bring it into the court, and he gets 10% of that.
Well, you mentioned that you took standing. Could
yes.
you give a little bit of an explanation of that? I appreciate in your book, I got the Kindle version of your book on my Kindle. And
uh-huh.
Read most of it so far. I've still got a little bit more to go. But I thought some of your explanations of commercial law and admiralty law and things were some of the clearest, simplest, you know, that an average guy should be able to fairly well understand what you've written. So I compliment you on that in your book. And I know that Red has a great appreciation for writers who write in such a way that you don't have to have 4 Harvard law degrees to understand them.
Right. It was written at a 9th grade grammar level, but the concepts are at collegiate level, you know, way up there. But if you get the language simple enough, anyone can understand the concepts. So that's why it was purposely done that way, so the general population could read it and understand it. Concerning standing. Standing is when the court has subject matter or personal jurisdiction over you, and you can take standing to argue any case. In my dad's case, I actually was not under the court's subject matter or personal jurisdiction, but I took it anyway, and the court allowed it anyway because the paperwork was so interesting to the court, he wanted to hear more about it. And as you can see, he basically undermined the entire system with his response to that. He basically condemned every complaint that goes through that courtroom that is not endorsed by the district attorney himself or herself. So that's how I see standing. Do you have a defining of it? Or?
No, you know, they came up with this thing, basically a legal fiction called standing, that they use to deny claims so that they don't have to hear them or allow evidence to be entered into the record, et cetera. But they just kind of came up with this method of telling people to go away because you don't have standing. And it really, I believe that it is a significant part of the corruption of our courts today. Because anybody who's an American citizen or a citizen of their state should be able to bring an action on constitutional grounds, and generally speaking, when they do that, they're denied standing. And is it the same thing to you, or is that
yeah? Well,
different?
One of the things, and if I understand probably the topic, when you see a constitutional violation, you acquire standing by moving in the capacity under a common cause with one who has a beneficial interest to see that a duty is performed or whatever it is the issue is. That allows you standing. But most people don't know that. The attorneys don't know that. See, you don't have to have a financial interest in it or even have an injury in it. You can move into any case in the country if you have a beneficial interest in it. That means it's something that will deprive you of a right if the defendant loses, or deprive you of a right if the duty isn't performed by an officer.
Well, then how is it that they have, you know, run all of these people off with these cases saying they don't have standing?
I bet you they did not raise beneficial interest and case law on it. If they raise that, that cannot be denied. See, I moved a case. I actually came up against the recorder's office on a lien that it had to be under the Uniform Registration Lien Act, federal lien act, and it wasn't under that requirement as far as having certification on it, nor did the Secretary of the Treasury certify the lien. So I came against her for a client, and the county moved it into the federal jurisdiction. Well, when it went into federal jurisdiction, neither the federal jurisdiction couldn't have personal or subject matter jurisdiction in this, and I did not have standing in that court, although I took standing in that court, only because it was a state issue. This was an in-house issue, had nothing to do with the federal government, even though the subject matter was over a federal lien. But it was I did it under a common cause to enforce a duty by the recorder that she has to follow the law. Well, and this was a real good, valuable case because something very spectacular came out of it. When the case was in there, and I actually had the son of these people who had liens all over the property represent himself under a beneficial interest in that federal court. And when the judge read that paperwork, she turned to him and said, "Hey, you didn't write this, did you?" And he said, "No, Your Honor." She said, "Well, this is a really interesting brief." And she says, "Well, who wrote it?" And he pointed back to me. I was the only one in the courtroom, so it had to be me. But at that point, the prosecuting attorney, two U.S. attorneys, one of them stood up. His name was Jay. I don't remember his last name. He says, "Your Honor, we're invoking the Anti-Injunction Act right now." Now, I don't know if your listeners know what that act is, but if you're a taxpayer and you've been liened and you want to argue the law in the case and you go into tax court to argue that law, they'll use that Anti-Injunction Act saying you cannot argue the law until you pay the tax. The only thing you can argue in a tax court is the amount of money if it's correct on that lien, whatever they calculate it for you. Otherwise, you have to pay that tax off, and it could be $1 million. They can allege any amount against you. And, of course, if you pay it off, you don't have any money to argue it after the fact anyway. Well, I could go into that case right now and argue under beneficial interest the law of the case. And I could argue the legal tender aspect of it. I can argue anything that if this person loses, I lose my rights in the matter. So that's important. That acquires standing in every case. If you have either a personal or beneficial interest involved in that case. Can you give me an example, Terry, about what types of cases are being pushed that they're being thrown out?
Well, primarily the ones that we've seen, I mean, there may be others that we're not aware of, but the ones that we've seen have been all of the eligibility cases. I know that, and also the one regarding the car dealerships, when Obama's administration shut down all of the conservative owned car dealerships, they basically you know, when they nationalized the General Motors, and
yeah.
And Stephen Pidgeon and Leo DiNofrio went together and filed suit on behalf of a bunch of these auto dealers that were shut down, that had their dealership franchises pulled from them.
Okay, now, do you see a beneficial or public interest that was denied right then and there?
Well, absolutely.
That's how you go in and acquire standing. You have to say, because of the public interest, a right has been lost unless it's corrected. Then you can argue your case. That gives you the standing to go before the court. But the way these cases are tailored, probably by the people you're talking about, they're arguing the issue and not arguing, first of all, their standing in that issue.
Well, I know that part of the reason they denied the standing was because there wasn't any one who had a different injury than the others. It was like, since they were all injured the same, then they classified it as you know, I'm not
right.
sure how they approached that, but that's basically what they said to them, was that, well, you've all been treated equally, so you don't have standing.
Right. Well, that's it. But see, I would argue the rights that were lost under a beneficial interest, personally, under a public interest if it affects the public at large. And at that point, like I said, they cannot throw it out on any grounds because it has to be heard.
But the eligibility cases, I mean, Mario
Puzo was
denied standing.
What are those cases specifically?
Related to natural-born citizen, Obama not being a natural-born citizen.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, what rights do you have that are lost in that case if he continues to be the president of the United States?
Well, there's every single person in this country.
You have the right lost in the Constitution, don't you, of the
yes.
requirement of the Constitution. That's a public interest case, isn't it?
Yes.
That's how it should be tailored. If you just attack the man and not bring forward the public interest that's being violated, you will not have standing in that court.
Well, I believe that Stephen Pidgeon did in his case, D'Onofrio did in his case, Mario Puzo. I think in each one of those cases they brought that out, but they were still denied standing. I don't believe it was proper. I think it was. I think it was unlawful what these judges did. I just think they basically had their possibly their families on the line. You know, somebody's got a knife to their throat.
Well, I can believe that because in that case I mentioned about the federal court that I was in, on the recording, the judge at the last moment when she was determined, and all I wanted was the case to go back into the county court, she was terrified. There was a continuance, and when we went back on the continuance, she was terrified, absolutely terrified. And when the attorney for the United States stood up, she said, "You shut up and you sit down right now." And she yelled at him. She says, "I'm remanding this back to the state." Well, the reason she was terrified, because this case was the first one ever to nullify the Anti-Injunction Act. That meant anyone could go in on every tax case and argue the law in that matter for the individual who can't argue it for himself.
Well, let's see. We've got somebody with a hand raised. Let's see who this is real quick. Area code 406, you have an open mic. Hey,
it's Dr.
Kate.
I'm back. Sorry, please just continue. Thank you.
No problem. That is our other co-host and producer, actually, Dr. Kate. And
I've heard her name.
I'm sure she'll want to get into conversation here soon.
Okay.
I guess we need to launch off into this the thing about the writ of prohibition and mandamus that you've been working on. You know, some of our listeners tonight are part of what's known as the All States Organic Initiative, which is a group that's trying to set up boards of review at this point across the country. We're just really getting out of the box on this, and you know, we've got an essay out there and a sample pro quo warranto charter that. Did I send you a copy of that? I hope I did.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did.
Okay. And we're thinking that what you're doing is going to be a tremendous tool that can be used by these boards of review.
Okay.
So I'd like for you to kind of give us some background on this. Maybe take us back to the beginning on what brought this up to you and how you came to this, and also what kind of reception you're seeing from it.
Okay, yeah. It started with a gentleman that approached me, and he had a felony from in another state that was brought forward. And he said, he asked if there's any way I could undo his felony. So, you know, getting all the facts of the case, I said, well, let me think about it. And at the point, I liked working on puzzles, and that's really what I do, is work on a puzzle, and law is a very huge puzzle. And looking at his case, it was he had $1.5 million outstanding owed to the IRS, and he tried to get it discharged in bankruptcy, but they wouldn't allow him to do that, and he filed a list pendant action against the officers that were involved, which is a civil action, not had nothing to do with them, and they charged him with when you put a barricade up in front of one of the officers and prevent them from doing their job, which is not true. You know, it's a civil action, and he never really crossed that line. So I thought about his case, and I like to tackle the foundations of everything. I don't care what it is. If you're going to find the flaw, it's going to be in the foundation. So I looked at the money issue, the amount he owed, and I said, well, could that possibly be a false amount that he owes? And I thought about it, and I said, I started thinking about the Supreme Court interpretation of legal tender and what the U.S. government and the Federal Reserve was passing around. And after thorough research, I researched every one of the legal tender cases, and even a current case called the Crummy case, which is in 2008, that referred back to the legal tender cases in the 1800s, I found one common denominator on the interpretation of legal tender by the Supreme Court of the United States. And that was, they all have to be redeemable. They have to, at one point, be paid. That was the common thread. The other common thread is they must be issued by the United States. So, wow, I said, wow, well, there's no redeemability in these legal tenders out there. So I looked at the code also, and it was Title 31, Section 5103, I believe it is. And in there, it gives the defining of legal tender. And then it refers back to the legal tender cases. Well, I put two together, obviously, and I said, wait a minute. If they're saying their right to issue these legal tenders are based on, you know, the current currency of the United States is based on the legal tender cases, and those legal tenders have to be redeemable, and that's the only interpretation the Supreme Court of the United States has ever made in defining the legal tender, then we don't have a legal tender that's in conformity with the supreme law of the land. So I said, okay, now how do we use this information? And I know the only door that allows the federal government in, as far as all its federal instruments, is the recorder's office. You close that door, and the federal government is not allowed into the state. So I said, let's attack the recorder, the office of the recorder, for recording these liens or these federal instruments in violation of the supreme law of the land, and that these federal instruments are based on legal tender notes that are non-redeemable. There's a maxim of law that says if the foundation is unlawful, nothing may be lawful or built lawful atop of the foundation. And that's the maxim. Well, these liens are built on unlawful Federal Reserve notes. Are you seeing that point clearly?
Yes. I don't know if everybody else does or not. I wish I could take a vote.
I wish you could, too, because I don't want to lose anyone on this. So, and I did not want to include the federal government in this matter. So how do I keep the federal government out? I make it a state matter by enforcing the public officer, the recorder of the county, to perform a duty she's compelled to perform, to uphold the law, not only of the state, but of the United States, and that she's not doing it. That's the writ of prohibition to prohibit her from recording this instrument. Now, as a respondent, that she's a respondent, and as another respondent, I brought in the sheriff. And I know we're going to get a lot of sheriffs on board on this. We already got a couple, and we have a couple of recorders from different states already willing to stipulate to this writ. And I did a writ of mandamus on the sheriff to compel him to see or oversee that the laws are followed in the recorder's office. So it is a state action. Now, the thing is that since this is the supreme law of the land, we're filing it in the Supreme Court as an urgent issue under a public interest, which allows us standing, and we're presenting it to the Supreme Court. Now, if the Supreme Court denies it, it has broken the law. If it grants it, then no federal instruments can come into the state because all the doors will be barricaded. Now, we're doing it simultaneously throughout every state because we need an action as vast as that to get the public media involved in it so everyone is aware of this thing happening. So once it's, and I gave it to you, I believe, I don't know if you can put it on your website or not, but it's right there, and that's the core of the entire issue. All we're doing is under a common cause, and a common cause is when I have a right to lose or the public has a right to lose if this continues to happen. And the common cause says that we have a right as a beneficial interest or a public interest to see that a public officer is enforced to compel, in accordance with their public duties, to compel them to do their public duties. So that's basically what it is. So it is in-house, and if the United States tries to enter this, we have to object, and they can be objected to because it is not a federal issue.
So what kind of ramifications does this have?
Okay, well, first of all, we're not destroying the Federal Reserve note. If we did that, we'd kill our state. So the use of the Federal Reserve note will continuously flow in commerce back and forth and everywhere. The thing is that the ultimatum is until such notes are in accordance and compliance with the supreme law of the land, that means they have to be redeemable, no federal instrument shall be recorded within the state. Now, do the states have that ability to do that? Most certainly they do. Does the sheriff have the ability, once he understands the law, to make sure it's done, to even to arrest the recorder's office, or even go and arrest the justice of the Supreme Court of the state if they commit a misprison of felony in that case, where they know a law is being broken and they're acting in concert with it? So no man's above the law. So there's a lot at play here. And I think the brief is about 44 pages long. It goes everything. It hits every aspect of it, from public policy, a case they throw that at us. And public policy cannot be used in this circumstance, even though they've been using these Federal Reserve notes, non-redeemable since 1968. They cannot use public policy, that it's been in there and therefore it's law. I hit everything I possibly could.
So tax liens, mortgage liens.
Yes. Now, we don't refer to them as that because we don't want to make it a tax issue. We purely use the general term federal instruments. But you got it right on point.
So make this very clear for the people that are listening what we're talking about, if you will.
Okay. What we're talking about is we are compelling public officers. We are enforcing them to perform their public duties in accordance with the office they are appointed to or have been voted into. So that's all we're doing in the state. It's a very simple process. It says that if you're violating the law, we're here to make sure you follow the law. And in accordance with the Supreme Court of the United States, the law is very specific on this. In every case, it has determined that legal tender is defined as an instrument that shall be redeemed and paid in a future time. That's it. That's as simple as it gets.
Now, this is based on Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution?
The right to contract? No, not really. It's based on state law and the oaths of office that each of the officers take. They have to take an oath to uphold not only the Constitution of the state, but the Constitution of the United States. And in that Constitution, the article, the commerce, and that's where your legal tenders come from, is the commerce aspect, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3. That's all commercial instruments, negotiable instruments, things of that nature. The Supreme Court has made their determinations on that, have interpreted what those instruments actually are, and that's never changed. They have never said legal tender are instruments that are non-redeemable. Not once in any case have they ever said that. All the cases have said they are to be redeemed. So how does the federal government and the Federal Reserve get away with printing non-redeemable notes? No one stopped them. No one raised it. But we can't go into the federal jurisdiction and argue that. So we do have a door in.
So this is strictly a state.
Strictly a state issue.
Strictly, yes.
That's how we can take back our states.
Did everybody hear that? Red, did you hear that? Red, is this the first time you've heard this, Red?
Yeah, pretty well. I find it very, very, very fascinating because, you know, we have used an entirely different program using the Seventh Amendment. Seventh Article of the Bill of Rights, and as far as I know, we have beat the tax court in every single case where we have used the process that I have talked about so much. It's the little guys. Remedy that really works, and of course, what this tells me, and my voice is really bad tonight.
But you're doing pretty good, Red.
I have to apologize, but this is one of the most interesting programs we've ever had, and I don't want to get left out. what it tells me is that truth is coming out of every nook and cranny within our system, and it's all going to it's going to bring about the day when our Heavenly Father, wipes out this federal God that we've got because of their violation of the First Commandment. And just like the USSR, I forecast that the USSR was not going to survive. And it didn't, of course. And this federal God that we have now is not going to survive either, because they are in clear violation of the First and Second Commandments. And so I'm going to have to be quiet here. I hope this isn't coming across too hard for people to understand. Here we are. We're coming at the IRS with the Seventh Article of the Bill of Rights, and they're just in big, big trouble. And, of course, I had sued a federal judge in Montana in 1993, and the case was docketed with the U.S. Supreme Court in 96, and it's still docketed. And they've got it buried. You can't find it. They have never ruled on it. But the Solicitor General in December of 96 told me I was correct and that he was not going to oppose me. So I'm going to have to shut up because my voice is gone. I've been doing too much talking. And so I'm sure sorry that that's happened. But I guess... Anyway, I'll try to visit with you sometime when I get a voice back.
Get you a drink of water. if it's okay, we've got a caller that would like to ask you a question or for some clarification.
I love questions. I love callers and questions.
Arnie, you have an open mic.
Thank you, sir. Mr. McDonald, a pleasure to meet you.
Well, thank you very much, Arnie.
In all of the research that's been going on, there appears to be quite a bit of confusion in that the current de facto government is indeed a lawfully seated organization. Is there something with respect to that status you can comment on?
Yeah, I can. I took a case, and it's written in the book, I took a case to the Supreme Court, and what I did is this was the same man that had the felony and the $1.5 million, and what I did is I was able to get a lawful $5 gold coin minted before 1933 into the accounts of the United States. And how I did that, and this caused a flurry in the courts because I didn't know what was going to happen with it, but they didn't know how to handle it. And what I did was tape it on, sent it by registered mail, taped it on to a caption, and the caption is that block up there that says USA versus whoever. And I said, in payment of $1,500,000. And in the argument, of course, I put that you have the negative and positive integers. In this case, the gold coin is a positive integer. It's like that apple out there. You can eat the apple with the gold coin. It has form and substance. Therefore, it is lawful. The Federal Reserve note, however, is legal because it merely has form only. And I don't care if it's backed by gold or not. The note itself is legal tender. It represents the thing, the object, or the commodity written on it. Well, it stayed into the courts for quite a while, and then it finally they decided to argue the case, and the court itself argued as the attorney, but I loved what the court did. I did 31 affirmative defenses and negative averments, and eight of them were negative averments, and not one of them were answered by the United States. In fact, in the entire case, of the motions I put in, not one response from the United States at all, which meant that we won the case anyway. But we didn't. But we actually did, and I'll tell you how. In the determination by the court said on the coin, it says, it appears the defendant did not place a value on the coin, if any. And what the court was saying is that it could not see that gold coin and ordered the coin returned. Now, it's a lawful coin under the Mint Act of 1792. It comes with law in it. That's one of its intrinsic qualities. It has the law side of the court in it. And the coin never was returned. It apparently was stolen or lost.
Why are we surprised?
Yeah. So I knew what I had there at that moment. I knew that that court couldn't see lawful money. So the first question's out of my mind. Well, first of all, I have to premise it with the Congress of the United States placed the value on that coin by the stamp on that coin, by the par value of that coin. And it did it under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 5, the right of Congress to coin money, regulate the whole thing. You know what that is.
Right.
So I said, wow, this is terrific. And I says, we need to get the Supreme Court to reaffirm this. So I wrote a brief, a writ of certiorari. I pitted the Commerce Clause, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3, against the Coining Clause, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 5, and showed that the legal tender was the paper money under that one article, and the gold coin fell under the other article. And what the defendant had done was issued payment and not discharge for the debt. And that case, usually when you do a writ of certiorari, they're handled within a week and you get denied. You know, they deny every one of them. This took 8 months. And finally, after 8 months, the attorney general decided he wasn't going to argue this case. And they reaffirmed the lower court's case. So what does this all mean? It means that if you transact your business in lawful money that cannot be seen by the United States nor by the IRS, do you have a tax owing after the fact as income? Well, what was my next step? The gentleman that I dealt with now is receiving gold coins. He received 3,000 of them the first year, put it on his income tax, stated they were lawful coin, pre-minted of 1933, and pushed it in on his income tax with some Federal Reserve notes on other matters, and they could not assess the gold coins. They could not see them. Does it ring any bells to anyone?
Yes, a lot.
Yeah, so you can see they can't, and here's evidence. If you were to leave this country with $10,000 in Federal Reserve notes or negotiable instrument checks or whatever, you have to declare it. If you don't, you broke the law. But if you left with $1 million of lawful money, you don't have to declare it. You can leave the country with all the gold coins pre-1933 that you wish. So from Arnie was, what about the United States, the lawful de facto or de jure United States? If they cannot see the lawful money, then whose government is it? That's the question. Now, you know the court by the money it uses. If it's a yen, it's a Japanese court. And lira, it's an Italian court. And if it's a lawful coin under the Mint Act, it's a United States court of America. But what if it's a legal tender Federal Reserve note? Whose court is it?
Well, just because they happen to be seen as the courts, who says they're the courts?
They're not the courts, and that's the point. They're not the courts. If they do not recognize the law side of the country, they are not the courts. And one of the things, you know, when I did a research on Title 26, the IRS code, had to do some briefing on it for a client, I came across a note where it was talking about in the subject matter of a subsection, it said the territories of the United States. And then I read the note, and the note was way in the back, and the note said the reason that the word territories was in lowercase is because the United States does not have any more territories. So upper and lowercase was still used quite frequently. And in the same, in Title 26, you'll will see courts with a capital C, and you'll see them with a lowercase c. So there is a different interpretation of these courts.
How about this point? A bank robber goes in and robs a bank and successfully gets to his home base with the loot.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, this is undetected for a while. But you know how things have a way of creeping out. And so after a long period of time, it became obvious what had happened. And as a result, the crimes have been noticed, documented, and the booty really belongs to the people from which it was stolen.
Mm-hmm.
So isn't it time for those who are aware of the crimes to go after those who have acquired the booty and return it to their rightful owners, and then prosecute those responsible for the wrongdoing?
Yes, it is. And I don't know if you read the book that I wrote, They Own It All, Including You. I talk about that, and there's a book that's referred to, Operating the Golden Goose, and it tells how the United States had loaned gold certificates to support the pound sterling and loaned them to France and other debtor European countries. It loaned quite a bit of money. And there was a moratorium that they did not have to pay these back. for 1 year. But besides that, these foreign countries, these debtor countries, already had a $9 billion outstanding war debt owed to the United States. So what happens when this huge amount of money was lent overseas? France and the other nations, but France mainly, came back with these gold certificates, went to the banks and started depleting the monies of the accounts, all gold that they could muster up. They had tankers coming back and forth depleting the American money out of here. Not only that happened, is that the foreign countries got together and started taking their accounts. All of them had bank accounts here, and they started depleting those accounts also, taking the gold out of them versus paper money. So you can see what they're trying to do. They're trying to decrease their war debts for pennies on the dollar, because now the United States went off the gold standard, and now inflation started for the first time, basically.
But this was all part of the plan from the beginning, from what certain research reflects, and
yeah,
the fact
well,
that we have...
Yeah, let me ask you the main question.
Yeah.
If your house, if you have a larder in your house and you have it filled with food, and you tell the person next door, hey, you can, I'll let you have this food today, you know, and you can come and use the food, you know, be wise on using the food in my cupboard, but use it. And they come over and they start depleting your cupboard. Wouldn't you say, hey, stop? There was no stopping this by the Congress of the United States. And
well,
it also proves
getting,
another point.
Now
had,
we're getting
had
down.
The gold certificates been backed by gold, why would they have forced the American people to give up all their gold coin and their gold certificates? Because it shouldn't have affected the American people. What they must have done is printed more gold certificates than what they had. They violated the law. And the third point is that if you look at the enumerated powers of Congress, they have the right to borrow money. Now, understand the word money meant gold or gold certificates. And they did not have the right to loan money. That's what got us in trouble. If you read the writ, you'll see I addressed that right on spot. On that one issue, and what had happened, and why inflation was deemed a bad thing for our society. It would destroy the society, and that's what they've done.
Okay, now who's going to pay for this?
Well, I don't know, personally.
Well,
I don't know. You know, it's a chain of command sort of thing, right? Sooner or later, when you get the lower inferior officers and you keep climbing to their higher officers, sooner or later you're going to get to whoever orchestrated these things.
Well, you know, the more we look back in the history, and I don't know how totally accurate this is, but I now have a vision which would seem to reflect that everything after 1865 is null and void, that we have not had a lawfully seated government since that time.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with you, Arnie. It is Arnie,
so it's
right?
All done by design. And systematically, each administration, each successive administration executed another part of the long-term plan, which gets us where we are today. The de facto money or the fiat money was used as a mechanism to enable certain elements, foreign elements who are controlling our government and the Fed, to take the riches in terms of fiat value and convert them to hard assets and completely manipulate and deplete the wealth of this country. And
yeah.
It's all been done deliberately by design and hidden from the people under color of law. Is that an accurate statement?
That's a very accurate statement. Very accurate.
So tell me, why can't we arrest members of Congress who have violated their fiduciary responsibilities? And tell me why we should even be permitting any part of this government to do anything that affects the American people?
You know, I'll tell you why we can't. It's because the American people are asleep to this information. They haven't woken up to it yet.
Yeah, well, not everybody.
Officers in Washington, D.C. should be railed out of the country.
Well, the people in Washington have absolutely no more impact over the people of America than does the executive board of McDonald's or Kmart's.
Correct.
So, essentially, the way I seem to understand this is there's a relationship between the states where the administration of the states, which I believe are not lawfully seated either, are sending money to the federal government in various ways. I'm not sure exactly how. The federal government takes their slice out of it and returns it to the state in forms of grants, less, of course, the federal cut, and returns the money in forms of grants when people do the bidding of this unlawful corporation or group of corporations. So we give them the money to blackmail us into getting our own money back, less their cut, if we do what they dictate us to do.
Yeah. But, you
is
know,
that accurate too?
There's one thing we have to wake up to, Arnie, is that it's not money.
Well.
Yeah, and that's how they get us, is because, and this is how they really get us. These are products of a foreign corporation. These legal tender notes don't belong to the United States. Title 12, Section 411 says that they're obligations of the United States. Therefore, you can't have an obligation to also own that obligation. You can't contract with yourself, oneself. That's a maxim of law, too. So they're foreign corporations. This was the Larkin Rose argument. Larkin Rose said there was nothing in the Title 26 that said they had to pay a tax, because a tax would only be on the profit made from a foreign corporation or foreign whatever. But they didn't realize one thing. The Federal Reserve is a foreign corporation. It is not a domestic corporation. And when you check the difference between your state tax, if you have a state tax, franchise tax board, that's a domestic tax. That's in-house. That's your house tax. Then if that's a house tax, that's within your own state, then what is the United States income tax? That has to be an international tax. It's outside of your house. It's a foreign tax. So you're in two jurisdictions, and you have to question, why am I in two jurisdictions? One is international and one is domestic. Well, the reason is because your Federal Reserve notes are foreign notes.
Right.
They're as foreign as a Japanese yen would be over here. Except because they use the word federal on it, we all think they belong to the United States. They do not.
But that's by deception.
That's by
and
deception
whole,
is right.
This whole scam is illegal, unlawful, and it has all been perpetrated against the American people since 1865 to some part or another, deliberately with deception in mind. They created the corporations without the consent of the government. So nothing in Washington, D.C. has anything to do with the American people and the 50 states of 50 union states or countries. Let's say our state is countries. Nothing.
Yeah. No, I can boil it down to, and you're right, it started right there at the Civil War. It probably started at the dawn of the country, basically. They had tried to do, the first thing they tried to do was take all the land away from the people. They didn't get that acquired until the last quarter of the 19th century when they passed the law of in perpetuity. In that law, they took out of every mortgage the right to leave that land to his heir forever and ever. So that was...
Yeah.
That was taken out. So now you have commercial land. Okay, so they took all private land away in the last quarter of the 1800s. What was the next step for them? Well, they wanted to take away the money of the American people, because it's a sequential order to unarm people. You have to do certain things. Once they took away the money, they've actually taken away portable land, because gold and silver are portable land. And that's where your rights come from. The common law is the law of the land. And portable land is also have that right in it. You know, all your rights from the Creator comes from the land, and that was taken away. The last one was in 1968, the last time you can redeem a silver certificate. So what's the next move against the people that you've taken their rights away, taken their money away, and taken their land away? You have to take their guns away. And that's what
they're...
Well,
now that you've confirmed what I have believed based on the research of all kinds of people, this is common knowledge. What kind of steps can we take now to begin to exercise our authority as the people and begin to, if necessary, city by city, street by street, block by block, take back control what rightfully belongs to the people, which has been stolen by fraud and deceit by all of those who are currently in office, plus all of those who were in office prior to this, because the theft is real, the theft is valid, the crimes are identified. So why are we permitting all of these criminal acts and actions to stay in place without recovering the losses that the people have suffered from those who have perpetrated these crimes?
Well, the first thing we cannot do, we cannot attack the federal jurisdiction, we'll lose.
Wait a minute. There is no federal jurisdiction.
It's a quasi-jurisdiction. It's the entire country is under the restraint of administrative law. And administrative law is martial law. And if you look up the defining of an agency, it's centralized government. Government means all powers are together. Decentralized.
However, let me interrupt you there, if I may.
Okay.
It was done unlawfully. Therefore,
I'm not arguing that point, but we're not at the powerful end at this point, and that's where we're trying to get right now.
Well, we have in our declaration in the Declaration of Independence, the ability to reform our government as it suits the needs of the citizen. Is that correct?
Yes, but I don't see that ever happening. That would be a revolution in a sense.
Well, but lawfully, we do have that right. There's
yes,
no
we
restrictions.
Do.
Today, I sent a note to the Provost Marshal General in Washington, and I have him being served this letter, which deals with the fact that Mr. Obama went off the reservation quite seriously by negating a law so he could provide weapons to our enemies. And Glenn Beck came out with a video and a piece about this act of treason. I wrote to the general, and I pointed out what Mr. Beck has done, but I also pointed out that Americans have been addressing these grievances with no response from Congress or their elected officials this entire period since Obama has come into power. And I went on to remind the general that he has until Friday, 5 p.m., Eastern Daylight Time, to respond to my request that he arrest the rogue government and bring it under control and restore peace and tranquility to America. Now, the point that's important about this letter is that I have included the statements that we have addressed everything up to this point and have not had any remedy. And so he is the point of last resort. And if he fails to do what is correct by his oath of office and protect the Constitution, then all Americans and the World Court of Opinion will have been notified of this fact. And that would give us, as the people, full rights and justification to exercise that part of the Declaration of Independence. That's paraphrase.
You know, I can understand that line of reasoning. I just don't see the American people backing it. The American people are so dumbed down, Arnie.
I understand that.
That's the fear. That's got us all fearful, because how do we take back the country when most of the people haven't got a clue, nor want to learn a clue about it?
Well, you know, there have been many of us have been working at this for some time, and, of course, I think we've made a lot more progress in the... Yes, sir.
You asked a question before about, you know, why is this happening? And I believe that I believe Ron McDonald understands really very clearly why it's happening, and I don't know that he's gone there yet in his thinking tonight, but I've heard him talk about it. And I believe that what's critical here is that we very clearly understand that we are in a spiritual battle. A lot of people have turned their backs on our Creator, and they don't recognize that they've got to keep Him at the top of the pecking order, or their rights don't even exist in essence, because they're granted by the Creator, their natural rights that came as a part of our existence because our Creator gave them to us. He's delegated it to us. He's the one that's sovereign. And Ron, I'd like for you to go there with that, because in essence, you know, even the gold and silver is a scriptural thing, and that's part of why it's in our Constitution.
It comes from the simple fact that one cannot serve two masters. So, and I often tell people after I've talked for a while on the radio, I says, you know, think about it. If your face is towards the state and you're following all these laws within the state, then the back of your head is towards your Creator. That should be reversed. Your state should be subjective to you, and you should be subjective to your Creator. But for some reason, American people and people around the world don't recognize that simple fact, because in that fact comes liberty, freedom, free choice, the right of free conscience. It doesn't come from the state. The state gives you permission. These are called civil rights from the state. Your states can only give you statutory rights. And that's the same thing with the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights was a restraint against the United States. That was a case called Barron versus Baltimore. They were never to touch upon those rights, and the people of the states were never to be touched by the federal government. That's the way it was until after the 14th Amendment. So you can see how we've topsy-turvied this whole thing. But the point is, and Terry's right. This has been a spiritual battle. I recognize it as a boy. It's been a spiritual battle, and we have to fight. And, you know, it doesn't matter if we win or lose in this battle. It's that each of us has done the right thing at the right time. We've chosen the right road, and that's the bottom line on these things.
Well, we do have some other callers. Arnie, I really appreciate all of your input tonight. I usually don't let people take over the hosting job, but you've done an excellent job, and I really appreciate your input. I do have
some other callers, Arnie.
I need to move on to.
No problem. Thank you for the opportunity. And thank you, Mr. McDonald. Appreciate your confirmation. And when you have some time, I'd like to chat with you some more about some of these things if it seems to merit your time.
Certainly. Certainly. Anytime, Arnie.
Thank you.
We have Ron, you know who Stephen is over in the Carolinas. I'm going to give him an open mic here. Stephen, you have a live mic.
Hallelujah.
Good evening.
How are you doing, Ron?
Pretty good, Stephen. How are you doing tonight?
Reasonably well for a fella in my condition. Gus is writing some briefs and legal arguments and whatnot. But he's got a question and asked me to present it to you on his behalf, if you don't mind. He's doing some foreclosure battles right now, and he's listening to the call, But he would like to know, and I guess all of us would really, how exactly would you model this approach to specifically address foreclosure issues?
Okay, well, I actually haven't thought along those lines, but the case that I would do it in a different direction. You know, the laws of the state, every state, are copyrighted, and there's special laws, including your banking laws, the mortgage, and everything else. If you were to attack a foreclosure from the sheriff or anyone else trying to pull the structure away from you, the property away from you, I would do a writ of prohibition based on what I've already done that got the Attorney General of the state of California to retreat, to actually withdraw the complaint in its entirety. And that, I think I mentioned it, that was the tax case, franchise tax case, where the contractor, who was also ex-mayor of Rohnert Park, a very plush area in Northern California, refused to take out state taxes of his employees. Well, I found that all the laws were copyrighted. Now, these become special laws or private laws, and this man was only under general laws. All people are under general laws. So what I did is I wrote an 18-page brief to the Attorney General, who was moving against him, and this was all for contracting under a revoked contractor's license, and he was the license was revoked, first of all, for not paying the taxes, and a year later, or 2 years later, he was caught contracting still with a revoked license. And what happened is, after this brief was put in there, I actually found the case where all the uniform fire codes across the country were being argued in a California court as to the percentages of ownership by private people. So these uniform fire codes were adopted by the state of California. And adoption is not the way we acquire law in this state, nor is it. Nor do we have the rights for restatement of the laws, where private people get involved and attorneys get involved and repeal some of the law, add to some of the law, and then call it a restatement of the law, and then the legislature adopts it. These are all violations of constitutional law. But in this particular case, because I presented all the possibilities on this copyright, the Attorney General did not want that getting out there. And he withdrew the complaint in its entirety, wanted no record of it. So that's how I would attack that, because everything falls under these copyrighted laws. And as the sheriff, and I would do the writ of prohibition against the sheriff's department and against the bank at that point on foreclosures. They don't have a right to use specialized laws to move against people when the Constitution itself was written in what language? Does anyone know the language that your state constitutions were written in? Common law. They were written in common law. So all laws coming from that delegation of power has to be under the common law. And you won't find these commercial banks in there. You will not find commercial law in there. So they cannot exist against you.
Right. If I may, you use the term do a writ of prohibition, or I'm not sure exactly
mandamus.
I'm not sure what language you used specifically, but I wonder if you can explain or expound on what exactly you mean. Are you suing for a writ of prohibition and mandamus, or are you writing a writ of prohibition and mandamus yourself and seeking to have it endorsed, so to speak? How exactly do you mean that?
Writing, well, in this case, it was the Attorney General. And what we did was write a writ of prohibition prohibiting the Contractors License Board and the state of California to move against this individual on a bill of exchange. He was given a bill of exchange saying he owed this amount of money. It was a sum certain. It was a time certain. There were three parties to it. The first party was the Contractor State License Board. The second party was this individual. The third party was the state of California. This made it a bill of exchange. And what I did is prove that it was a commercial law and that the Constitution of the state did not emanate from commercial law. It emanates from common law. And there is no authority traceable to the Constitution for that aspect of it. Also, on the constitutional aspect of it, copyright law cannot ever be a law that people are subject to, because in copywriting a law, there is an owner, and the owner has the right to sell the laws, like all the laws of the state, of whatever state you're in, can be sold to another nation, a foreign nation, an enemy nation. They can change those laws at will because they own the copyrights to them. And that's precisely what I proved in this case, and that's how I would prove it against the foreclosure. Foreclosures are copyrighted laws adopted by the state. They're special laws. They are not the general laws that you would fall under. And at the dawn of this country, all property was owned by land patent. That meant it could never be liened, and there was a reason for that. No bank could ever use your property for security because it was already used in the old country. Back there, they would seize your property, foreclose on your property, and they didn't want it happening over here. And this is why all the land was given to the United States under land patent. And when you bought the land, you owned the patent to the land, and it cannot be touched. It was a place where you sustained your life, grew your food, sustained the lives of your family, and earned your living. And that's what it was meant to be, and that's what it should be today.
Right. And, of course, beyond that would be an allodial title.
Well, that's, basically the same thing. Absolute ownership.
But, my question, I need to go back to my question, because the writ of prohibition and mandamus, the prerogative writs, historically came from the king against someone, or from the court against someone. And you say that you're writing the writ of prohibition and mandamus, not suing for a writ of mandamus and prohibition from a court.
Well,
so
actually, we're suing for, and in this case, you'd be suing the bank on moving against the property on foreclosure.
Let me finish the question,
okay,
please. Are you writing the writ of mandamus and prohibition as the sovereign and issuing it from your own dominions? I'm not clear on what exactly you mean.
Okay, are you talking about the writ that I've developed?
Yes. Let's go with that, because I think that's what we've got to focus on, because I think the listeners are going to want to hear this too. This is the way I was going to structure the question. Instruct us as a person in a county that wants to take your writ, why they should or shouldn't change anything in it other than what's appropriate to make it pertaining to that county.
Right.
Who signs that writ? How do they go about getting that signature on that writ? And then who do they take it to file it?
Okay. The person that signs it can be anyone. Anyone that has a little bit of gumption and knows that there's no injury for filing these things, because your position or status in there is just a citizen wanting to see a public duty enforced. That's all you're doing. So there can't be retaliation against you. So you could sign it. Your neighbor can sign it. But other people can join the writ, too, under a common cause or under amicus curiae. A common cause...
Like a border review?
Yeah.
Like
a border review, absolutely. On a common cause, there's money that has to be transacted with the court. But on an amicus curiae, you become a friend of the court, and you can still argue the issues, and there's no cost for joining in a case on that respect. So you could have one person, two people, five people, 100 people sign the writ and bring it to the Supreme Court as beneficial interest, or public interest would be probably the better, but some may have beneficial interest. It doesn't really matter. And then you can have 10,000, 100,000 people join in on a common cause or amicus curiae and support that writ. Now, the way that I say to do it is that before you file any writs, you go to your county sheriff and you say, I'd like you to read this, explain what the nature of it is, explain that the county recorder has not been following the supreme law of the land, and this is the reason why. Every case that has gone through the Supreme Court on the determination of what legal tender is says it must be redeemed. That is a fact. That is the law. That cannot be. No man's above the law. Everyone has to follow that law. But the recorder hasn't been following it because she's been filing instruments in her ignorance that have been based on non-redeemable notes that do not follow the law. And we know that we know the maxim of law that if the foundation is unlawful, nothing lawful may be built atop of it. So you explain it there. Ask them if they'll stipulate to it. And if they stipulate to it, file it against them as respondents, and they'll give you no argument in court. And your state has to grant it at that point.
So you take it to the recorder's office.
Yeah, you take it to the sheriff first because sheriffs are a little irked about the federal government and what it's been doing. So, and many of them, like I said, we have, I think we have three sheriffs in California already willing to stipulate to this if we go into their county. And we have, one guy has a recorder up north of me that's willing to stipulate it. She's had enough. She's tired of seeing foreclosures come through and federal liens come in on properties, but she's bound to have to record them. And she doesn't want to do it anymore. She sees what it causes. And, you know, innocent people are losing their properties. They've done nothing wrong. They've only followed the law that the government has messed up, destroyed the economy, created inflation, deflation, depreciation. These people are innocent, but what do they get for their hard labor, for working years and building a fortune for themselves? No matter how meager the fortune is, it's theirs. They get to lose it for doing the right thing all the time. So the county recorders are ripe for this sort of thing. It's a matter of just talking to people.
You know, up until now, all the sound money legislation that's been attempted through more than a dozen states have died along party lines, and there just hasn't been enough grassroots support for it. It seems to me that if the people in the counties can form boards of review, which is basically Stephen, you might want to help me out here, but I'm going to say this in the way that I think the listeners will understand. A lot of the folks listening are familiar with common law grand juries. Well, the problem with a grand jury of any kind, whether it's common law or not, is that it doesn't have the authority or the teeth to go and prosecute. So enforcement becomes a problem, even if they issue a presentment saying it should be prosecuted. But in the case of a board of review, you can put 25 people that are qualified electors in your county together, and you can have them sign on to one of these writs of prohibition and mandamus, and go out there and approach the sheriff or city account county commissioners or whoever it is, and have them stipulate to this. And absolutely have all the teeth in the world to enforce it to its fullest extent, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And isn't that the most wise direction and strategy to use is go to your enemy first and ask if they see the value in changing America back to a very wealthy country again, bringing the people's status back up again, changing the law so that a man has a right to free destiny. You know, who would argue with these things? The sheriff is in there, too. I know he has people in his family that have lost their house, have liens from the IRS. I don't think there's anyone that I know that hasn't had some form of antagonism from the Internal Revenue Service.
I think these people are ripe to talk to.
And get them to stipulate. And if they don't stipulate it, go to another county.
Well, and once you get it started, you're going to have grassroots support coming behind you big time, but it's also going to put a tremendous amount of pressure on the elected officials at the state level to reinstitute sound money.
Yes. And the bottom line is no one gets injured in this. We don't stop the Federal Reserve notes from passing and being exchanged. That's not our goal. We're not going to fight the federal jurisdiction. Let the money cross borders. We don't care. We're just saying that until it does become redeemable, any instrument that's built up on that cannot be filed here in the state of California or here in the state of Arizona or Colorado or wherever. Cannot be filed.
Well,
makes
what
sense
kind of
to
effect
me.
Is this going to have? What kind of effect is this going to have on the state treasurer?
He'll still be getting his cut of Federal Reserve notes. I don't see any change in business. It will be. I don't even think it's going to injure the United States. You know, it's all a scam. They don't get the money. I remember as a teenager when I had to file an income tax, and I wrote a check on Crocker National Bank to the IRS to pay whatever measly sum I had owed. I get the check back, and it'd say the Federal Reserve Bank on the back. It never went to the U.S. Treasury. So, you know, it's all been a scam. It's an illusion. It's, again, remember I was talking about the gold, the lawful money, the gold coin, and the legal tender? It's like the apple. How many imaginary apples is equal to one real apple? I don't care if you have 10 billion trillion imaginary apples. None of them will ever equal the real apple, and that's that gold coin. None of these Federal Reserve notes will ever equal even one of them. If you stacked them all up, none of them would equal it. Not all together, not singularly, none of them would equal it. One carries law, and one carries the appearance of law.
So are we saying to our listeners, we want you to organize your county, put together a border review, take this writ, and go record it?
That's what you're saying, and I'm agreeing with you.
Stephen, get busy.
That's it. I mean, you know, I put the Gmail, the email account on there, so we can start connecting and evolving into a larger movement. Now, on the other hand, I did the seminar with this, and I got movers and shakers to get involved in this, so people with money. And we have other seminars that are coming up with movers and shakers to fund this thing. I mean, people are starting to see the worth of this. So, but we need more than what we have. And we need – do you see the wisdom in getting this filed into every Supreme Court state about the same time? I think there are some states that will just say, hey, we're passing it. We're granting this. And there will be other states that will say, no, I don't think so. But again, the sheriff has the most power within that state. His duty is to see that the law is upheld. And if he sees a violator of law, imagine sheriffs getting together and arresting the governor of the state for violating law, and he has a right to.
Well, a good friend of ours up in Montana who's in our chat room right now, on our online chat room, was talking about how a state legislator in Montana tried to pay his state tax in coin, and they refused to accept it.
Yeah, they can't see it.
They can't see it. Now, you've been saying that. I'm not sure our listeners understand what you mean by that.
They cannot see the law side of the government. And the law side is when let me explain it this way. Lawful is form and substance. That means when you have something lawful, you would have like the shape of the coin, that would be the form, and the substance would be the gold. The legal side of the government means you have representation of that thing, of the commodity. For example, your attorney goes into court and represents you. That's legal. When you go in and represent yourself, that's lawful. It's the difference of the two jurisdictions. You don't belong in the legal jurisdiction. Never have. But they took control of us in 1933.
So what does administrative... that say? What does that say to the spiritual battle?
Well, this is how I explain that. On the lawful, on those gold certificates and silver certificates, it says, "In God we trust," and they represented gold and silver. So which God do you think they were talking about in that, on those notes? The real God. And what about on the legal tender that appears to be money but doesn't represent anything? And it says, "In God we trust." Which God are they talking about in that one? Because both these notes are opposing. One is a commodity, and the other one is nothing.
It's really counterfeit because, and the reason the reason they can see the counterfeit is because they are counterfeit.
That's it. So the legal note is an illusion, and it's beguiling, and people think it's money. And what was the last power? What was the only power that Christ left with Satan? The ability to beguile. And we have it in the most important system of this country, the circulatory system, that touches upon every service and every product, that feeds man, that clothes man. We have that illusion on the backing of how that transaction is to be. It's beguiling that we think it's money, and it's not money. It is debt, and it deprives us of our rights by our Creator. It seems that everything that we have had from a creator has been replaced by a statute. For example, your license is a grant to you to use your talents from God, but it's no longer your talents from God. It is a talent granted to you from your state. That is so abhorring. I see it so clearly. I said, the state has tried to take the place of God. And it's very well has done that in the hearts of many Americans because they don't know any better. They don't know God. They don't know that the rights come from God and have never come from the state. The man should never be regulated. He's a free man. He's been given free will. Well, tell me how much free will you have when you have to get in the car, wear your seatbelt, you have to drive at a certain speed here, or you have to stop here, you have to act like a trained monkey on everything to follow these artificial laws. When God's law is right there, God says, a man may say, go around this curve at 45 miles an hour. If you go faster, we'll ticket you. And God's law says, go around, see how fast you can go, but I'll tell you this, if you go too fast, you're going to break my law. And that law is the crucial penalty, isn't it?
Give our listeners a brief distinction between common law and commercial law.
Okay. Well, common law is the law of the land. It is from time immemorial. It comes back from tried and true principles. And I expressed one of them tonight. I said, if the foundation's unlawful, nothing lawful can be built. Everyone should recognize that. Or one can't contract with himself. Everyone should recognize that as to cause an injury to himself. You can't do that. These are reasonable principles. We have a lot of them. And all law in this country, except for the federal jurisdiction, was under the common law, except for Louisiana, and that's Napoleonic law. But the common law was our birthright. It comes from the Magna Carta. It comes from the Declarations of Rights in England. I think there were two of them. And it comes down to us, and it's our birthright. And it says that the state shall never touch upon anything a man does, including his right to labor, his talents, or anything else. The only thing that the government was intended for was to protect those rights. It was never to restrain or restrict or to regulate any of these rights. And I have a case on that. It's In re Jacob. And it is the best case I've ever come across in my life. And that case explains it all, what government's function is. That's common law. And common law can be described as this. In a crime, you must have an action plus a damage to equal an injury to form a crime. Okay, so you have an action and a damage. That equals a crime because you've caused an injury. But what about commercial law, legal law? In that, the equation would be you have an action equals a crime. You go 35 miles an hour in a 25-mile-an-hour zone, you have an action only, no damage. It costs a crime. Now, admiralty and maritime law. These are laws in the commercial jurisdiction, and admiralty law is contract on the high seas in the time of war. Maritime law is contracts on the high seas in the time of peace. So that's the difference between them. Now, what is commercial law? Commercial law deals with any line, lane. For example, your airlines, your train lines, your sewer lines, your water lines, your telephone lines. These are all commercials. Trucking lines, highway lines. These are all commercial. They can be regulated by the United States. That's within their powers to regulate them, although they've never been granted power to do that. They've made these commercial only because it appears. Now, if you look at the term regulate, look at where it says the right of Congress to regulate the coin, the value of the coin. Now, you would think that term regulate means to it could limit it, decrease it, decrease it, increase it, whatever. But if you look at the next sentence, it says, and also foreign coin. Could the United States or could the Congress of the United States decrease the value of a foreign coin, increase the value of a foreign coin, eliminate the foreign coin, or whatever? No. So that word cannot mean to prohibit or stop or arrest the coin. It means to keep it regular or standard. And that's the only mean, that's the only defining of the term regulate. And it never meant to stop a man from doing things or to regulate his talents. That's never been there. That is something that they realize they can change the nature of by changing the defining of, and they've went with it. And guess what they've done with it? They destroyed all our lives with it. You're regulated in every aspect of your life. Every time you flush a toilet, you're in commerce because you're dealing in a line that can be regulated. So basically the difference is that commerce, commercial law is in representation. For example, you get that birth certificate, and I give a copy of a birth certificate where it actually shows that it goes right to the Department of Commerce. What are you doing in the Department of Commerce? What is the birth certificate with your name on it doing in the Department of Commerce unless you're commercial property? You're owned by someone. So, I mean, there's a lot more to it, but that's a simple defining of it.
Well, I want you to be able to tell people a little bit about your book and your website before we're done. We've got about 22 minutes left. Before I let you kind of close us out here, I'd like for Dr. Kate to give herself a live mic. I know you're muted, Dr. Kate, but I'd like for you to jump in here. I know you've got a comment or a question that you'd like to contribute, and if nothing else, just say hello to Ron McDonald.
Yeah, I'd like to meet her.
Oh, Terry?
I'm on.
Now we hear you.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Terry, I thought I was the host, and so I muted you and didn't unmute myself. My apologies. Thank you very much for your discussion this evening. This is Dr. Kate. This is just terrific. We need to have you come back. And I've been agreeing with and chatting with Terry as you've been discussing. And it looks pretty good. What I'm struck by is the counterfeit. We've in another show, Terry, Red, and I have been talking about this notion of Satan and his inability to be creative, so he counterfeits. And the whole money thing is just perfect, because when you were saying that the people can't see gold, for example, they can't see it because they're in a different paradigm. Also, people are spiritually blind. They can't see God.
Yeah.
And this system that we're operating in, kind of blindly, although people like you are waking many of us up, is a counterfeit. And so we need to step over to the other side and root ourselves in common law and begin to hold people accountable. So I'm thrilled, because what we've been talking about in our other discussions are how do we keep God at the top of the pecking order as we do our work in this world right now, given everything that's happening. And this is about the clearest way in discussion I've heard of how those two really might connect and are real. So when people are, quote, choosing things to work on, you know, people need to choose God and then listen to what God says how. And it looks to me like what you've done is really open up an avenue that is very good. I guess, Terry, Red, you'd probably say he's made himself available. And it looks like you have. So I want to thank you very much, and don't want to take too much time, Terry. So, but please come back. Nice to speak with you. Thank you.
Same here, Dr. Kate. Yeah, I should tell a story about a friend of mine that has an orchard. He grew different types of trees, and he asked me for the first time I went over to his house. He said, "Ron, come here. I want to show you what I grew." And he showed me the pear tree and the apple tree, and I said, "Well, that's interesting, but what part did God play in it?" You know, people don't get the importance of what part does God play in your life. Is he the reason you have power? Is he the reason you have food? Is he the reason you have thought process? And what about the state? What part does the state play in your life? Has it replaced God in those sources? Well, today it has, or most people think it has, and they're going as though the state has taken control over everything. But that's not the truth of it. If everyone woke up tomorrow and realized how important God is in their lives, the state would dwindle down to a capacity that would be controlled and be the servants of the people.
You know, there's people who have been attacking the Constitution, and one of the things that I enjoyed about the part of your book that I've read so far is that it reminds me of how our Heavenly Father really did have a hand in the founding of this country. One of the ways that they attacked the Constitution, of course, is the Commerce Clause and some of the other things that kind of left a crack in the door, if you will, open for this rogue counterfeit shadow government to justify them sticking their nose and their hands where they don't belong. And I appreciate the way you wrote it, because it just gave me that reminder, and I needed that, because the more you look at the way things are, you got to wonder, you know, if some of them being Masons or whatever really did set this up so that the central government could grow in its power in spite of having the chains of that document.
Yeah, one of the things, and I probably should bring this to light only because it's something that I recognized early in life, in the state, and this is what I say when you turn your face towards the state, the back of your head is towards God. In our state in California, we have the Great Seal. And on the Great Seal is the goddess Minerva, also known as Athena. And I don't know if you know the worth of a seal, but a seal authenticates and executes every law in the state. So a false god is on every law of the state, and Christians who believe they are Christians are bending on knee towards this false god, because every time you obey a law that's authenticated and executed by the goddess Athena, you're having a false god before the real God. And I don't care if you have a bear on your seal of your state, you are bended on knee and you're worshiping that authentication and that enforcement of the law through those seals.
Indeed. Well, the one thing I noticed about your writ of prohibition and mandamus, so many people have come to the decision that they'll never find remedy in the courts, because the courts obviously are now basically administrative, commercial courts. The judges are not public servants. They're really not judges, so to speak. They're really administrators of the commercial law. They don't represent the people or the state. They represent the corporation. And if you disagree with that, jump right in and tell me you disagree with it. But my point is this. Your system seems to function in that arena, and it's like walking into a dark room with cockroaches all over the floor and shining a big light on it. Because I got a feeling that's the kind of response we're going to see when we do this, when we take this and act on it. Because if the people that are listening to this and the people that we contact about doing the board review are not willing to take this tool which you're providing and shine that light in that dark room, if they're not willing to act upon it, then it'll never do anything. Our unalienable rights will not defend themselves. Our Constitution will not defend itself. It takes the people to do it, and it takes the people to do what you're suggesting. But you've given us something, like you said, that doesn't hurt anybody. But I do suspect we're going to see a lot of cockroaches running for cover.
Oh, I agree with you. I definitely agree with you. And I agree with your analysis of it. It really is that. It's just that if the law is being broken by an officer of the state, by a highway patrolman or whatever, we have a duty to report that law, because we can be charged with misprison of felony for not reporting a law. I don't know if your listeners understand that, but whenever you see a crime happening, and even if it's at the recorder's office and that recorder is filing liens that should not be filed because they're based on instruments that are not in conformity with the supreme law of the land, she's committing, even in ignorance, a violation of law. And you have a right as a citizen to make sure that every officer in your state follows the law, and you have a right to make sure it's enforced. That's why you cannot be injured in this. That is your position. You're going in to make sure that a duty is enforced.
Well, I like it. Red, do you have any question that you'd like to get in? I know your voice is probably still pretty bad, but just want to give you a shot here if you want to say something.
Well, I just want to reiterate what I said earlier. I just really appreciate this, and I just know that what is happening in this country is these gems of truth are coming out, and that's what I've heard here this evening is truth, and it's something that we just haven't seen very much of it or heard very much of it for a long time. But I'm absolutely convinced that our Creator has decided that this is the time for a lot of this type of thing to come out and make a difference in our country. And we're in terrible shape because of our being so dumbed down, of course. And of course, I've been fighting this for many years, and this just thrills me to death, because I see God answering prayer, and He's answering the calls of those who are being hurt so bad because of all of the violations of God's law. The people of this nation are being damaged severely by violations of God's law. And Ron is talking my language and I really appreciate that, so I better leave it at that, but I'll be trying to be in contact with Ron in the future when I get my voice back, perhaps. But just thank you again for coming on the program. We needed this, and I'm just so convinced that it's God's time for this kind of truth to come out. Thank you again.
You're welcome. I'm going to say the same thing I told my friend. I said to myself, I grew the tree, or what part did God play in growing the tree? That's the same thing. I don't take the credit for this. I don't know where the thoughts come from. I don't think any of us really know where the thoughts come from. I do know where my thoughts come from when I do something along the lines of freedom. They come directly from the Creator. So this is why it's out there. It's to free the country, and it's a very simple thing to do. We're not talking pulling up guns. We don't have to overthrow any governments. We don't have to do anything to injure our families. We're doing a very quiet takeover and stopping, putting the obstacle in the way of the federal government. That's the first beast. The second beast will be the state, and we'll be handling that right after.
Well, you've got about 9 minutes, so you want. I've posted your website, newpeopleorder.com, on our chat room a couple of times now. That's where someone would go to find out about your book, also, is it not, Ron?
Yeah, they can go there, or Amazon, or Barnes and Nobles, or most bookstores sell it right now.
The name of your book?
They Own It All, Including You, by Means of Toxic Currency.
Now, the by Means of Toxic Currency is not inside the parentheses, is it?
Yeah, no, that isn't. Including You is inside the parentheses.
Now,
all you have to do
is
say They Own It All on the Internet. It'll bring you right to the book or wherever.
In your book, you mention that the counterfeit currency may be, and you don't say may, I'm putting the word may on it, may be the mark of the beast.
I know it to be the mark of the beast, personally. And, there's a point in Revelations where it says, and the merchants on the seas were lamenting as Babylon burns. I can see this currency being burnt. I can see it being destroyed. And it is the mark of a beast because it touches upon everything. Tell me one sector that currency doesn't touch. It goes into your grocery stores. It goes into your schools. It goes into your house. It pays your PG&E, your water. It goes into the birth of your children. It attaches on to everything. I don't care what it is. If you buy property, it attaches on to it because the lien, that hidden lien in there, transfers over from the Federal Reserve note into the very thing you have. And I explain in the book how that lien got there, what it is, and I also explain what actual lawful money is. And what transfers out of lawful money is absolute ownership, title, rights, and interest, besides an infinite number of other qualities, into the very thing you transact for. So if you buy a table with a $20 gold coin, you transfer all the absolute title rights and interest into that table, and you own that absolutely. No one can take it from you. Due process is the only way you can take that away from you. But if you buy it with a Federal Reserve note, the lien, the hidden lien in there, by mere maritime hypothecation, that's a lien to a creditor, that transfers into that table, and then you have procedural due process to take it. Sometimes they take your car off the highway, if you're driving under the influence. I don't suggest anyone does, but they can take it. Before 1933, they had to go into court and claim they had a right to take your car before they could take it. After that, it's procedural due process. Whatever the procedures are by the agency, they follow it. And again, the agency has the right to create the laws, adjudicate the laws, and enforce the laws. It's centralized. So you're never going to win. You're just not going to win unless they violate the procedures. We find ourselves in a horrible position right now.
No question about it. And I had something on my mind, and it just went blank.
I've been doing a lot lately.
Well, I really appreciate the way you approach this. And as I told you in a private conversation before, I've come to a decision that I'm not going to even spend my time trying to fight a battle with people who don't understand keeping our Creator, our Heavenly Father, at the top of the pecking order. And I appreciate you mostly for that, and I believe that a lot of your inspiration comes from that. And I believe that if we're going to have success in anything we do, it'll be because of that. And that's why I believe that what you're bringing forward here is of great value for that reason, if no other. So we appreciate you,
it does come
Ron.
From God.
Any other questions? Any phone lines are still open if anybody's got a question they'd like to get in here. I know that, Stephen, you still have a live mic if you're still on. Any other questions that anybody's got? We got about 4 minutes left here.
I'm still on, but I don't really have any questions except when can we seriously engage each other to the end of incorporating what you're doing with what we're doing with the Lords of Review? I think they're meant to be together.
We can start it immediately. You know, the biggest failure is people who don't act. Am I right? These things have to be acted upon.
Right.
That's the key to success.
Amen. We'll
Amen
be in
is
touch.
Right. Yeah.
Well, we need to get our website loaded. We've got it up, but we don't have content on it yet. We've got to get that on there. I've been wanting to get to it this week, and we will do that. And do you have any objection to me putting that that writ on there as a document that people can see?
I want everyone to see it and have a copy of it. I want everyone to understand it, because this is a simple trick in the whole thing. Once we get these into the Supreme Court, people start empowering themselves, and then they can see that they have power over their government. They've shut the door to the federal government. And I know there are recorders and sheriffs in counties across the country that'll stipulate to this and say, hey, it's about time we have a remedy. You know, bring back the Creator into the state. Bring back real money, because when you do, you bring back the treasury of God besides his people.
Yes,
that was a
comment I wanted to make earlier, and I forgot. In several places in the scriptures, when the Father was speaking to the people of Israel, both through Moses and later through Joshua, he said, when they went in to do battle with their enemies, to remember the gold and the silver are mine. There's significance to the gold and the silver, to the government of the people.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, the other thing too, and as you can see, we're starting to use their laws against them. As Red said, the Seventh Amendment, that's their laws, and Red's using it against them. It's the people are waking up. It's a spiritual battle, and people are being armed by these strategies that have come to them. I agree with Red. I think we're going to see a lot happening over the next several months.
Amen.
Well, if nothing else, we're going to see truckers shutting down D.C., huh?
I know. Isn't that great?
Amen to that.
Yeah. Yeah, there's action, right? Action. And they're no different than you and I getting together and doing something. But they're making a point.
Yes, they are. Stephen, would you close us in prayer real quick? You got about 45 seconds.
Sure. I don't know if I can do that fast, but I'll try. Hallelujah. Father Yah, we thank you and praise you in the name of King Yeshua for your blessings, for being with us tonight and bringing Brother Ron to us again. Father, we look forward to merging our various working projects together so that we can serve your people, our people, in this great federation of nations. We love you and thank you and praise you in the name of King Yeshua. Amen.
Amen.
And you did it in 45 seconds. Thank you, Ron, so much. We do want to have you back on, but we'll be in touch with you shortly. I know Stephen and Gus are ready to get moving, and so we'll set up a time, okay? Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Terry.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, all.
Good night, Steve. Good night, Red. Good night, Kate.